Hi, this is Dr. Benjamin Levy. I'm the Clinical Director of Medical Oncology for the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center here at Sibley Memorial Hospital. Thank you for listening to my podcast. Today, we're fortunate to be talking with Dr. Channing Paller. She's an assistant professor of oncology at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center in Baltimore, who practices both in Baltimore and in our Washington location at Sibley Memorial Hospital. We'll be talking today about the clinical care and ongoing research in the prostate cancer world. So, Channing, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So, Channing, you're a native Washingtonian, and you've come back to practice medicine here in D.C. in addition to your practice in Baltimore. How did this all go down, and how did this happen?
Yeah, so I have great family and friends in the area, and I had been told in medical school that I could not hope to have a mentor, friends, and family all in one place. Well, when Hopkins selected me to be a resident, I thought that I might be an exception. So when Hopkins expanded its world-class cancer care to Sibley, I was ecstatic, as were my parents, as I can now work a mile from where I grew up.
Yeah, I think it's so important to have that family support and be practicing medicine around family. It does make a big difference in that work-life balance.
It does. It's also my husband insisted I get a place down here after we got married.
Okay.
So that added to it.
Okay. I know the feeling. So you've had, have you had particular patients whose cases altered how you either view your role or how you practice the art of medicine?
Yes, actually. And it was a patient in your world of lung cancer. So about 10 years ago, I ran into a 6-year-old patient who had stage 4 lung cancer and came to me with severe toxicity from her chemotherapy, including nausea, vomiting, sores in her mouth, could not walk from the neuropathy. She was just plain miserable. And so we took a look at her because she said, I don't want any more of this chemotherapy. And we sequenced her tumor, and she was found to have an EGFR mutation. And a drug had recently come out for that called Tarceva. And so we started her on that drug. And she was very excited to have a targeted therapy, except for the fact that 2 weeks later, she developed a full body rash and hypothyroidism and diarrhea and was just as miserable and just as mad at me as she was with her primary oncologist. So good news was there was a recent study showing that lower doses of this medication could work just as well as higher doses. And so I lowered her dose, and she now has been doing well for 10 years in complete remission from her lung cancer. And she is the only non-kidney, bladder, or prostate patient that I keep because I so enjoy her care, and she is happy, and our meetings every 3 months result in her updating me about her travels around the world because she's doing so well and has no evidence of recurrent lung cancer. So it's patients like her who have a mutation where I can target her cancer that drive me to find more mutations like this where I can make cancer a lifelong illness that I can treat and people can live with and live well with.
Always makes me proud to hear, as a lung cancer clinician and researcher, lung cancer patients impacting on my colleagues who don't do lung cancer. I think there's always something to learn from different tumor types, and we can take away certain messages that help us apply what we've learned to another disease state. So you don't do lung cancer.
Right.
you've moved over into the GU world. Interestingly, I was formerly a prostate cancer researcher, and I moved to the lung world. So we've crisscrossed.
Yes. Why is that?
I think that a lot of it has to do with the impact of mentoring and being around people that you gravitate towards that do a particular tumor type, and that happened with me. And I thought the science was picking up and getting very interesting. Like you said, the role of identifying a mutation and giving a targeted therapy was very appealing to me. So you've moved over now into the GU world and do prostate cancer research and clinical care. What's the focus of your research been in this field?
I have had a long-standing interest in natural products ever since I learned in 7th grade that the periwinkle plant had activity against cancer and that the first chemotherapy was from Taxol, a yew tree. So I would say focusing on therapies that are less toxic and enable a better quality of life. One area that I focus on is looking rigorously at integrative therapies, including food supplements that patients are taking with the hope of delaying the or preventing their cancer, but we have no evidence that they work or don't work, or if they're safe or not safe, and in what context. And so the patients ask our oncologist, should we take them or not? And we don't know. And so I am starting to study those drugs to see if they're worthwhile taking and for who they're worthwhile taking.
And do you find that patients, I find in my world, we don't have a lot of research in this in lung cancer. Are patients receptive to this type of research? To me, there's a lot of enthusiasm with patients wanting to find out about these natural products and repurposing them or looking at their real therapeutic or preventive value in cancer. Do you find that enthusiasm there for your patients?
The enthusiasm is huge. It is just as hot for that, if not more, than immunotherapy because of the limited toxicity associated with many of the natural products we study.
Yeah.
So we have a 10-patient waiting list for a trial we're not opening till August of a natural product that I'm studying.
Yeah.
And we're opening it nationally at 10 different sites.
Yeah.
So people are very excited, and they're often paying for it out of pocket because they want to try it and see if it works for them.
Yeah, I think it's an untapped resource. I think there's a lot of things we just don't know about many of these products, and we need to look at them not only because they're readily available, but because the cost is probably a little bit better, and there may be real value in these drugs. So kudos for you for trying to better understand the value of these drugs, specifically in prostate cancer. In lung cancer, we talked about this before, but we have these biomarkers that we test for, like EGFR and ALK. The bottom line is we try to look at the genetic underpinnings of a tumor and understand what the genetic alterations are. And if they have a particular genetic alteration, you can wed that to genotype-directed therapy, otherwise known as targeted therapy. I'm biased. I think lung cancer is the poster child for personalized medicine. But, you know, I'm learning now that it's not just in lung cancer. So what are the biomarkers that you are looking at specifically in prostate cancer?
Yeah, when I started, there were none. In the last 10 years, we've developed several. The first one was a circulating tumor cell we look for a marker called ARV7 to see if you'll respond to two of the newly approved therapies for prostate cancer or not. Mm-hmm. The cancer gets smart and chops off the binding site to the drug, where the drug would bind, and so that is one of the therapies that we know to use or not use depending on this biomarker. And so I'd say we have four at this point, three that have been FDA approved, and one that's we're doing a phase 3 trial on. So the first one is looking to see do our therapies work. The second one also looks at a different blood marker to see if there's a certain mutation in the cancer, and we can apply a therapy that's already approved in breast and lung cancer for our patients, and it works well. A genetic mutation, many people have heard of it, BRCA or BRCA, as well as similar mutations. And then the third one, we like to call the President Carter drug, is Keytruda or pembrolizumab. There's a 1% chance that people have a mutation where they'll respond to immunotherapy very well. Which is not very active currently in general in prostate cancer. Yeah, the fourth biomarker that we're developing at Hopkins is related to natural products. So we have done a pomegranate trial and a muscadine grape skin trial, and the active antioxidant in those compounds are only helpful for 25% of men. We did a placebo-controlled trial and found out that it was completely negative for all comers, but for patients who had the mutation, which is about 25% of men, they benefited about 15.8 months in slowing their prostate cancer.
With pomegranate? Or
with muscadine grape skin.
Okay.
With pomegranate, it was 12 months.
Huh.
And that was a UCLA study, not even through Hopkins.
And this is a biomarker within their tissue? Or
this is a biomarker that is their normal body cells.
Okay.
It is how they process antioxidants.
Okay.
And so we have figured out mostly by watching our patients who were taking them, and some people responded dramatically, and we finally did enough testing that we were to figure out who were those patients and why were they having such an amazing response to something so simple as pomegranates or muscadine grape skin, with the primary component being ellagic acid.
Wow.
And so this is a big trial. We're running 320 patients nationally. It'll be open at Harvard, Karmanos, Fred Hutch in Washington, so university. So it'll be open around the country, and I think we'll be able to definitively answer this question. So I've made the biomarker. It's called superoxide dismutase, and it tells us how you process antioxidants.
And what is the prevalence of that biomarker?
25%. So there's 700.
Not a small number. Yeah. Okay. And so we think a lot about biomarkers, as you mentioned, either, you know, these genetic variants that people are born with, germline mutations within the tissue. There are biomarkers we can identify in the blood. But then the microbiome is also a rich biomarker specifically and potentially for immunotherapy. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I was pretty excited in November when there was a science paper showing that in kidney cancer, which I also treat, immunotherapy worked on average about 25% of the time. But when people had a certain microbacteria in their gut, their response rates went up to 40%. And so we wanted to capture that and say, could we apply it to prostate cancer patients and other patients to say, are there ways to increase that particular gut bacteria? And then will they respond better to immunotherapy as a result? And so in the literature, it actually turns out that the components in muscadine, grapeskin, and pomegranate, ellagic acid being the main component, promote growth of this bacteria. So a healthy diet of red, green, blue that we always talk about is actually what will help us do better and make healthier gut bacteria, which allow us to respond better to immunotherapy.
Yeah.
And so we're also doing a trial just to look at people's microbiome. Yeah. We call it the poop study.
Yeah.
And we are trying to increase response rates to immunotherapy so more people can benefit from that therapy.
Yeah, who knew stool would be a rich source of, you know, information to help identify patients that may or may not respond to immunotherapy. And I know Hopkins really, and across tumor types, has really started to look at the microbiome. I know one of my colleagues has a sticker that she gives to patients when they participate in these trials that says, "I poop for progress." So I think that there's a lot that we can learn. It's a fascinating interplay between the adaptive arm of the immune system and cancer, and trying to understand how this complex interplay works through microbiome studies in the stool is one could only think this was a joke 10 years ago, and now it's reality. So there's a lot I think we're learning. So you're involved in a lot of research, and certainly the biomarkers that you've mentioned and some of the therapies you've mentioned. You have an interest in vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, right when I was getting out of the prostate cancer field, I think you can correct me with the trials here. TAX-327 was the docetaxel trial that showed, it created a standard of care. And I guess the docetaxel is still utilized in prostate cancer. You're looking at vitamin C with docetaxel. Give us an understanding of what your thinking is there and why this may have some synergy and where you're going with this.
Yeah, this is a fun story. So vitamin C, it's not what you think. It's not the vitamin C that you pop when you have a cold. That's an antioxidant. This is vitamin C that's given intravenously, and we give you super high doses. And so it has an oxidative effect, which is different in that it kills cancer cells. So this story started way back when with Linus Pauling, when he treated patients with intravenous vitamin C, and they were found to live longer than the patients who didn't get the intravenous vitamin C. They then started to want to study it again. And in particular, Mayo picked up this study and said, oh, we'll try it orally. So they tried it orally, and it did nothing. And so vitamin C was forgotten for 25 years, not until Mark Levine, an endocrinologist at the NIH, showed that intravenous vitamin C was completely different from oral vitamin C. So oral vitamin C gets to about 80 micromolar versus intravenous gets to about 10 or 20 millimolar.
Wow.
And so the difference is it's a huge difference. It produces hydrogen peroxide that is accumulating in the cancer cells and kills them. The cancer cells do not have catalase to break it down, whereas your normal tissues do. And so people, it's in a sense a form of targeted therapy. So coming around to why I chose to study that, there was a study in ovarian cancer of chemotherapy with vitamin C versus chemotherapy alone.
IV vitamin C.
Okay. And patients did much better. There was a trend towards overall survival, mm-hmm. and there was a decrease in side effects from the chemotherapy. They could get more chemotherapy, and overall they felt better. So the Prostate Cancer Foundation sent out a request for proposals for people to study this. And me being interested in quote-unquote natural products or integrative therapies, immediately I got 50 emails from people around the country saying, Channing, this was written
right
for you. Please study this.
Yeah.
And we were lucky enough to work with the Marcus Foundation and get a $3 million grant of support to pay for a national trial looking at this therapy because it's not supported by a pharmaceutical company like Merck or someone else.
Yeah.
And so we now have opened a trial looking at prostate cancer patients, and we either give them electrolytes or we give them vitamin C with their chemotherapy.
And how many patients is in our...
It'll be a total of 60 patients.
Okay.
And what I'm noticing is there are some of them that are seeming to do much better.
Right.
I can't prove it until the results come out.
Sure.
But on average, people, as you said, from the study that approved docetaxel, get 5 to 7 cycles before they progress.
Yeah.
A number of my patients on this trial are staying on trial and doing well for 10, 12 cycles.
Wow.
And so they're really feeling well, and they're celebrating things like their 50th wedding anniversary, and so they're loving me for it.
I assume that because this is a natural product, quote-unquote natural product, that the IV vitamin C, there's not a lot of side effects with this. Is that a fairly reasonable thing to say? I mean, the beauty of that trial is not only that it's novel and not only that it's looking at this natural therapy, but they're very well tolerated, right? There's not a lot of side effects with these infusions.
Correct.
Yeah.
In fact, it makes people in general feel better.
It
acts like a sugar molecule on the brain, although it's not sugar, and people feel better. Two of my patients wanted to climb on the roof to clean the gutters.
Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting because I think we are coming into a world where we're thinking about, you know, combination strategies of drugs rooted in scientific rationale. Oftentimes that comes at the cost of cost. We're adding these really expensive drugs to other drugs.
Right.
And I think you're heading the other way in a very novel way.
I am and I'm not. There was a science paper looking at intravenous levels of vitamin C on colon cancer cells, and they found that it actually killed a certain type of cancer cells in colon cancer called KRAS cells.
Yeah.
You guys also have them in lung cancer.
Yeah.
And so we actually think this may be a therapy to target those cells in the future.
That's great. Do we know of any other, or is there any thought what the biomarker may be, or is there an enriched group of patients that have prostate cancer that would do better with vitamin C than those that don't have a particular mutation? Are we thinking it could potentially kind of capture all the patients in terms of its efficacy?
We're thinking it potentially could capture all of the patients in terms of the efficacy at this point, but we are looking at a bunch of potential biomarkers to see if we can find one.
Yeah.
Because it does take time. People have to come in twice a week to get the therapy.
Right. It's fascinating. It really is. I'm very much look forward to seeing more efforts like this. Again, I have some interest in this, looking at repurposed therapies that don't cost that much that you can add to drugs to see if you can improve the outcome, and trying to understand predictive biomarkers of those combinations. So I think that it's a fascinating field that's really been untapped.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've obviously been leading the way in some of these efforts in prostate cancer. You've talked a little bit about your research, talked about the biomarkers potentially. Tell me, in terms of just clinical care, what do you like to talk to patients about when you see them?
Well, in addition to helping them live longer with less toxicity, I like to talk about their vacations. And I say that because patients with cancer, it's a stressful situation. And for me to transform a patient with metastatic cancer into one that's talking about visiting family and friends and enjoying their life means I've done my job. I've gotten their cancer under control or put it to bed, and so they can then go live their life and enjoy.
Yeah.
It means we're doing something that we're supposed to be doing, and they can live with what could be a chronic disease as opposed to a deadly disease.
Yeah. How do you achieve balance? You are very much invested in the research. You are grant supported. You are writing papers. You're treating patients, and you have a family. What is the message to the more junior oncologist who's coming out, who's trying to balance all these things?
Life is short, and so I try and do everything that I love. And I try and make sure I prioritize things that are important to me. So another trial I'm doing that's funded by NIH is oral immunotherapy that's even less toxic than the standard immunotherapies that are approved in addition to standard of care. And I have an incredible husband and caretaker for my child and close family in the area, and they help make this possible so that I can do what I love and spend time with them when I'm not at work. And so I am lucky to have these people in my life.
Yeah. Importance of balance.
It is.
It does help feed the, it helps rejuvenate and refresh when you have to go back to work every day and be on the battlefield of battling the cancer and coming up with research ideas. So thank you, Channing, and thank you for listening to this very interesting podcast on prostate cancer. The Kimmel Cancer Center digital footprint is continuing to grow. You can now subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Hopkins Kimmel. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you on the next podcast.